What is it?
On Sunday morning, one of our U-2s took these pictures. The Soviets are putting medium-range ballistic missiles into Cuba.
Morning, gentlemen.
Morning, Mr. President.
Our cities in the southeast, as far north as Washington, D.C., are in range of these weapons, and in the event of a launch, we'll have only 5 minutes' warning.
In those 5 minutes, they could kill 80 million Americans.
Well, it's clear we cannot permit Soviet nuclear missiles in Cuba. We have to get those missiles out.
The Soviet understands only one language, action. Respects only one word, force.
I got a bad feeling about what's going on in there.
Sir, I think we have to issue pre-invasion orders for our forces.
There's no choice. It's going to cost lives anyway we go.
We're talking about possible nuclear war.
We've got a bunch of smart guys. We lock them in a room, but they come up with some solutions.
Full spectrum of airstrikes is minimum response the Joint Chiefs will accept.
No, no, no. There is more than one option here.
You're in a pretty bad fix, Mr. President.
Well, maybe you haven't noticed you're in it with me.
Those damn Kennedys are going to destroy this country if we don't do something about this.
A lot of things are going wrong today. It's making everyone nervous. The more things go wrong, people will become more nervous, and it will be very hard to avoid going to war.
3, 2, 1.
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
This is a setup.
They want a war, Jack, and they're arranging things to get one.
What happens to you?
I'll be evacuated with the president.
And while you're under a rock somewhere, what am I supposed to do with your 5 children?
Sometimes there is only one right choice. And you thank God when it's so clear.
Stop that firing!
Lied right to my face.
Tenet, we need you to talk to them.
And nobody plays us off each other, and nobody ever, ever gets between us.
Let's wish for a second somebody else was president.
You mean that?
I said for a second.
First airstrikes start in 28 hours.
The world's watching everything we're doing.
I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over.
I am the Commander-in-Chief of the United States, and I say when we go to war.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Film and Water Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I am your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this week to talk about the 2000 drama about the Cuban Missile Crisis, 13 Days, starring Kevin Costner, is our pal Michael Bailey. Michael, thanks for doing the show again.
It's a pleasure to talk about something that I can link to geeky stuff, but isn't like a geeky movie. You know, this is a pretty straight ahead historical drama, so it's actually kind of nice to talk about, you know, the something that doesn't involve, you know, people in long underwear and such. So.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I first asked Mike for what kind of movies he would like to talk about, this was on his list, and I was so shocked at that because I think I really thought I was the only person that A, saw this movie, and B, really likes it. I think it's a terrific movie. But I don't know anybody else that's seen it. And so then when I saw it on your list, Mike, I was like, oh, we got to talk about that one. Because it's like, I have nobody else to talk about. This is, like I mentioned, it's a dramatization of the Cuban Missile Crisis. For anyone who's not familiar with what the Cuban Missile Crisis is, it was a literal, as the title suggests, a 13-day period during 1962 in October where the Russians had moved nuclear missiles into Cuba, which means they were within striking distance of the United States. This was in violation of several different treaties, and the United States basically went toe-to-toe with the Soviet Union, and this was probably the closest that the world has ever come to nuclear war. That we know of, yes, of course, that we know of. And it was one of those moments that, you know, it was sort of just a test of character between Nikita Khrushchev, who was the premier of the Soviet Union, and John F. Kennedy, of course, was the president. The movie is told from the point of view of Kevin Costner's character, who is Kevin O'Donnell. And mm-hmm. Kenny O'Donnell went and wrote a book about this time, and that is what this movie is based on. It stars Bruce Greenwood as President Kennedy. It stars Stephen Culp as Robert Kennedy. Dylan Baker as Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense. And a bunch of other actors, really solid character actors, all playing real-life people in the moments of leading up to this extraordinary crisis. So, Mike, when did you see this movie? Why do you like it so much? I mean, what's your history with it?
I saw it in the theater. My wife and I, when we first started dating, we went to the movies all the time. Like, we saw just about everything. We saw that god-awful remake of Planet of the Apes in the theater. So,
okay,
you know, our well was deep. And I saw a trailer for this, and I turned to Rachel and said, I want to see that. And she didn't want me to see it, because when I was a kid, and even up until my 20s, I would have screaming nightmares about nuclear war. You know, growing up in the 80s, you know, just in the Cold War in general, but I think the 80s was a good hot spot for this, because you had things like The Day After and Countdown to Looking Glass and other movies like that. So she was a little worried that it would give me nightmares, literally. But I saw that trailer, and there's a shot of Kevin Costner, Stephen Culp, and Bruce Greenwood walking down a hallway.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, wow, the Kennedys look like badasses. I want to see this. So it just, and I am a sucker for historical dramas, especially ones set in the 60s. And one of those that I love, which isn't historically accurate, is JFK.
Yeah, slightly not historically accurate.
But I love the look of that film.
Oh, it's a great movie. It's a great movie. It's a terrific movie.
So, you know, and this film is as you would say, chock-a-block of that kind of thing, where down to the glasses people are wearing and just the atmosphere of the dress and everything. I mean, this looks like, you know, it makes you feel like you're seeing something from the 60s. So I just desperately wanted to see it. We saw it. I enjoyed it. I bought the DVD when it came out. I mean, I love the music. I have the score. So this is like one of those films that I go to when I just want to kind of kick back and watch an enjoyable character movie. This is one of my go-to movies for that.
Yeah, I've always been an informal, like, student of history, American history, from, say, like, the 30s through the 60s. That period has always been very fascinating with me. And if you read, you know, books from that time, you'll see a lot of the same people carry through. I mean, all the people in this movie, all the quote-unquote characters, are all, of course, real people. You've got General Curtis LeMay, Dean Acheson, Adlai Stevenson, Dean Rusk, you know, the Robert McNamara, who I mentioned before, Ted Sorensen. I mean, these are all people that sort of carried over from different administrations, you know, and mm-hmm. on and on and on. And around the same time, or not around the same time, but like a year or two after, there was another movie put out by HBO called Path to War, which is about the Lyndon Johnson presidency. And a couple of years before this, there was Oliver Stone's, back to Oliver Stone, his Nixon movie,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a terrific movie. And I tend to watch, when I want to watch 13 Days, I tend to watch 13 Days, Path to War, and Nixon all in a row. Like, it's a trilogy because it's successive presidents. Mm-hmm. Each three of these films feature a lot of the same actors, sometimes playing the same role, sometimes playing different parts, but it feels like a rolling documentary because you're seeing these same names pop up over and over again. I mean, Robert McNamara was the defense secretary for John F. Kennedy, and then he became the secretary for Lyndon Johnson and got us, you know, he was the main architect of the Vietnam War. And so for someone who's interested in these films are really essential. And this is the one that kicks it off because it, you know, any film obviously that features John F. Kennedy is inherently sort of a sad movie
mm-hmm.
because you know the end game here. But this presents him, I think, very fairly. I mean, it doesn't get into the personal details of these people's lives other than Kenny O'Donnell. You basically only see Kennedy as the president. You only see Robert F. Kennedy as
Attorney General.
I don't know why I couldn't piece the words together. Attorney, I'm like, district attorney. No, that's Matt Murdock. No, Attorney General. So you're only, you know, you're seeing them in their official roles, but you do get little glimpses here and there of, you know, while this movie is very pro-Kennedy, I mean, it kind of sort of has to be because it's telling this story where he kept us from getting a nuclear Armageddon. It does throw in little things. I mean, there's a great scene where he's so frustrated with what's going on, and he talks about, you know, not even wanting this job.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Kenny O'Donnell's like, are you serious? And he's like, well, I just said for a moment. You know, I mean, like, for that second, he's like, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be the guy that's standing between us and utter destruction. And it's like Bruce Greenwood is terrific as John F. Kennedy. I mean, he's really solid. He looks like him. He sounds like him. And he just gives you that sense of, like, you buy that this guy's a president.
And there's little subtle touches. You know, I don't know if a lot of people are aware that Kennedy had a pretty serious back problem. And there's a couple times where Greenwood in just his performance will be walking and suddenly you see him, you know, like if you've ever had back pain that just flares up on you, you know that move essentially.
Yeah, you see him grimace. You see him go like that. And he's, just a little
and he's
thing,
you know, taking his medication with his alcohol because, you know, that's just, you know, because that makes it, you know, increases the effectiveness of it. One of the best supporting characters in this film, and it's going to sound snarky, but it's not, are the accents. Because, no, because Greenwood and Culp have that kind of, and even Kevin Costner have that kind of, you know, like, you know, almost Harvard lockjaw Boston accent about them. You know, there's this great moment between Costner and Greenwood at the beginning of the film where Costner starts eating his breakfast.
No, right, yeah.
And he goes, right. I was eating that, you Boston. And I was just like, that's so great. And even the kids, all his kids have these like thick Massachusetts accents. And it just, it makes it feel more real. The great thing about the cast of this film is, you know, you've got your heavy hitters, but I watch more Law and Order than is probably healthy for a human being.
But well, there's a lot of it to watch, you know.
Yeah, well, that's true. But, like, just about all of the side characters from this movie were on Law & Order at one point or another, or a bunch of different times. So it's interesting seeing them in this, like, different position or these different roles. And, you know, Costner is one of those actors, I think, that he either is engaged in the movie he's in or he's just sleepwalking through it. And this is definitely one of those movies where he was, you know, he was a producer, so obviously he had stake in it. But he was on his game in this movie. And I think, you know, he really helps carry it in a way that, you know, he helped carry JFK as, you know, a completely different character involving Kennedy. So I just, Bruce Greenwood was just so amazing. It's kind of interesting the career he's had. Because he's like Mark Harmon almost. He was like a heartthrob on St. Elsewhere.
That's right. That's right.
And, you know, most people nowadays would probably know him as Kirk's dad in the new Trek, as they call it.
No, he's Captain Pike.
Oh, Captain Pike, not Kirk's dad. What am I thinking? Duh. It's Thor is Kirk's dad. That's right.
That's right.
But he's also the voice of Batman on Young Justice.
That's right. I forgot about
that. So he's got this range that I don't think he really gets like the credit for as an actor. But I'm I love him as JFK in this film. I just think he is just so into the part. And like you said, like the times where he's frustrated, you feel frustrated. And anybody who's been in any position of authority. And I know the president, you know, stopping nuclear Armageddon isn't like the same as having to deal with like associates at a department store or in an office setting. But you, when you're put in charge, there are those moments where you're like, I don't want this. Yeah. Why do I have to make this decision?
There's an amazing scene where he's talking to General Curtis LeMay, who was, I think, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and was, for all intents and purposes, a complete loon.
Yeah.
He never met a country he didn't want to bomb. And he's talking to Kennedy, and he's almost gleeful that this has started to happen because he wants war. He wants to engage war. And he's pretty much saying, yeah, the Russians will fire some of their missiles, and it'll kill some Americans, but we'll kill more Russians. So and then he says and so Kennedy is kind of hemming and hawing, trying to decide what to do. And LeMay says, you're in a pretty tough fix, Mr. President. And the room just goes silent, and Kennedy's like, what did you just say?
Yeah.
He's like, I said you're in a pretty tough fix. Well, he's like, if you didn't notice, General, you're in this with me. You know, and it's like, yeah, because if the world blows up, you're going to die too, you idiot. And, you know, the character of Slim Pickens plays in Dr. Strangelove, the one who literally rides the bomb down, you know, like a horse, is based on Curtis LeMay. And from what I've seen of some documentaries, people said that's actually being charitable to Curtis LeMay, that representation in Strangelove. So, yeah, he was a real loon. And Kevin Conway is the actor playing LeMay. He's great. I mean, he's fantastic. And following that scene where after LeMay walks out and he's frustrated that he's not getting the war that he wants, Kennedy has a great line where he says something about, you know, the beauty of these guys' positions is none of us will be around to see that they were wrong. And I thought that's a really wise sort of way of looking at it, because it's like, you know, yeah, you'd love to be able to hand it over to somebody who you know is wrong. That way you could show them how wrong they are.
Yeah.
But of course, you can't do that because we'll all be dead. And so that's why your position can never be proved wrong, because your position leads us off the cliff. So it's, you really do get the sense of how much the army in a lot of sense wanted this war. And they thought Kennedy was weak. They thought he was sort of this Boston, you know, fancy lad. And they thought they could muscle him into getting the war. And Bobby Kennedy talks about that. There's lots of scenes where he's like, they're boxing us in with these rules of engagement. They want this war, and they're sure that they're going to force you to give it to them. And that's pretty terrifying.
Well, I think you also hit on one of the great things about this movie is that the conflict is these great scenes and exchanges. And sometimes it's not even a verbal exchange. It's just the look. There, like earlier in that scene, LeMay was like approaching, like almost getting in Kennedy's face, and Costner moves himself in front of the president. Like, no, you're not getting anywhere near this guy. But like all of the arguments and all of the exchanges, when you have, not Adlai Stevenson. No, Adlai Stevenson has a pretty awesome moment.
Oh, there's a whole scene about that. We got to get to the Adlai Stevenson and in the UN scene is tremendous.
But when they actually have the first bit of the embargo, you have Dylan Baker really underplaying to the point where he's just brilliant as Robert McNamara.
Oh, he's great. Yeah, he's terrific.
He's like arguing with the admiral, and he stops him, and the admiral just gets all indignant, like, we have rules of engagement since John Paul Jones. And he's like, you idiot, this is a new language. This is Khrushchev and Kennedy communicating with each other. John Paul Jones.
And he like spits. He's so mad because the admiral is like, we were just firing flares. And McNamara is like, but I didn't know that. And if I didn't know that, maybe the Russians don't know that. And we can't take that kind of risk with these old rules.
Yeah, it's just, and I love them. I love all the exchanges. One of the most interesting performances of this movie is Dean Acheson, who's played by an actor named Len Cairo.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I would not pick him out of a lineup in this film, because I watch a lot of Ion, because I'm, you know, I'm over 40 now, so I'm obligated to watch Ion. But I watch, you know, Blue Bloods comes on every Thursday, and he's the grandfather
of
the family, and he doesn't look anything like he does in this movie. So I'm like, oh my God, that guy is so into his performance that I don't recognize him from another thing that I see him in on a regular basis. And he's great because he just comes in and he's got everything figured out about the Russians. And when he walks out of his meeting, his first meeting, he's just like, he's all pissed off. It's just like, this is a movie of men in suits angry at each other.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of action. I mean, there is a couple of scenes with some jets flying around and some of this. But this really is scenes of just guys in rooms talking. And yet it's incredibly gripping, and it's 2.5 hours. And I never feel like it's too long or it's – and one of the things that – another thing I like about it is that because it's based on real events, it is not structured like a typical movie with the three acts. Mm-hmm. The movie kind of almost concludes in the middle and then picks up on another whole section because that's what really happened. At one point, they thought that this crisis was over, and they realized, no, a whole other problem is now opening up. You wouldn't write a movie like that. You would lead up to the giant conclusion and then the movie's over. This movie ends halfway through and then starts over. And that in some films that could be deadly. But to me, this just makes it that much more – has so much more tension, because you're like, oh, we're all okay. Everything's great. We talked the Russians down. And then you're like, oh, no. A whole other thing has – and a whole other problem has sprung up. I checked this movie online for like how – closely to historical fact it was, and according to most of the sources that I saw, it's pretty close. Robert McNamara said later that he felt that Ken O'Donnell's role was a little enlarged, because he's like, Ken O'Donnell was not that significant a player in this. But of course, Ken O'Donnell wrote the book, So he probably inserts himself. I guess he's a Mary Sue in a certain, extent. He's inserted himself in the story as the hero. And the, this film is told from his point of view. Like I said, it's his family we get to see. His are the only scenes where he's outside of his work. There's a scene of him talking with his sort of like a Russian counterpart when Robert Kennedy's having a meeting. So, but from what I read, most of this is pretty accurate. You know, they got the details right. And for something as terrifying as almost going into a nuclear war with Russia, you don't need to jimmy this.
Yeah,
you have enough tension by itself.
And it's one of those things that it's surprising it works because we're all here, so obviously everything worked out. You know, it's we're watching something where we know what the conclusion is, but like all good historical dramas, you get so caught up in what happened. And you know, the tagline of this film was, you know, we don't know how close we came. And you know, you and I were born in the 70s, so we have no idea. And I've asked my dad, who grew up on military bases around Europe, his father, my grandfather, was a mechanic for the Air Force. And for years, I thought that meant that Papa John, yes, I had a Papa John, you know, sling your jokes, you know, if you feel like. But, you know, Papa John, I was like, oh, he's working on the jets. No, Papa John worked on the missiles.
Ooh.
And, you know, these are people that have like a much different perspective on this. And I asked my dad, you know, what was it like? And he's like, it was scary. Like, you know, and he was in Colorado at a baseball game during the midst of this, like a AAA game. And somebody started setting off fireworks.
Oh, jeez.
And he's just like, we saw a giant flash in the sky and we thought that was it. So it's just like, you know, you and I really can't fathom that at this point.
Yeah, thank God. Yeah, thankfully.
Well, yeah, thank God. But it's just, and that's why I think I like these movies, because these people are like in the thick of it, and we get to see all different perspectives. We do get to see the military people who are presented as the antagonists of the piece. And, you know, like, you know, LeMay comes out of that one meeting. He's like, these goddamn Kennedys are going to, you know, are going to be the death of this country, which was a common sentiment about JFK during his administration, from what I understand. And I think that's why I love it so much, is because, you know, I don't need explosions. I mean, I love explosions. I love fight scenes. I love action. But I also love watching actors chew through their dialogue and get completely and utterly caught up to it. I think Stephen Culp is so underrated in this film, but he's just like, he's like this third, you know, piece of the foundation. I mean, we're all focused on JFK and Kenny O'Donnell, but he's like in the background doing like the work basically. And he's such an interesting actor. You know, nowadays you see him more on television, and he was in, he was one of the senators grilling Black Widow at the end of Captain America Winter Soldier.
Oh, that's right. That's right, yeah.
And but I think, you know, he really kind of embodied that, you know, what Robert Kennedy was doing during this whole, you know, this whole series of events. It's like his introduction is great. And one of the neatest things about this film, one of the things that I love, and the director did this on purpose to give it a period feel, is sometimes in scene transitions, it'll go black and white.
Oh, yeah, yep.
And it goes black and white in some cases on photos that have become synonymous with the event. There's that one photo of Kennedy standing in the shadows near a window, and they frame that beautifully. But when Culp comes in, he's just like, what the hell are they thinking? And it's just, you're just kind of dropped in the middle of it, but there is enough real world stuff. Like, we get to see Kenny O'Donnell's day at the beginning of this film. He gets up, he yells at his kids because his kids got a bad report card.
This is your report card.
There's two phones in his house. There's a black phone and a red phone, which is not the bat phone, people. I just want you to know that. He's not talking to Commissioner Gordon and Chief O'Hara. And when the phone rings, everybody stops and looks at it, and his wife picks up the black phone, and everyone kind of relaxes. But, and we see him, like, you know, talking to the secretaries, and he has this, you know, she's in the film for like 30 seconds, but I love the Jackie Kennedy scene.
Mm-hmm.
of him arguing with her, like, to, like, you can tell they're friends, but that she's in his way and he's in her way, so they're just nattering at each other. Meanwhile, in the background, these people are looking at the photos that are basically setting up the film, and it just, it eases you into it, but once you're in, it doesn't stop. The drama just doesn't stop. So it's almost like the beginning of a horror film, where you're just seeing everybody get kind of set up, and then the killing starts, and you're just, like, kind of engaged on that level. But this is, well, obviously there's not anybody. Well, that might have been an interesting twist to the film. I'm sure historians would probably have a problem with a serial killer running through the White House. But
I think, isn't that that movie with, what's his name, Harvey Dent as the president? Isn't that what that thing is? Yeah. Yeah, it's funny that you mention that, because, yeah, it has that scene with Jackie Kennedy where she talks about, you know, we're throwing a party, and Kenny O'Donnell looks at the list, and he's like, no votes there, no votes there, no votes. And she's like, I don't care about votes. This is a party. And he's like, come on, Jackie. And then those guys in suits come in, and they're like, Kenny, we need to see the president. And he's like, well, okay, how about two or maybe five? And they're like, no, now. And
yeah.
He's like, oh, that's not good. That's not good.
And I love all of the side characters. You've got, as I mentioned, you have Dylan Baker, who is one of those, like, solid, I think, character actors, playing Robert McNamara. You got Ed Lauder, who's just born to play a military official.
Yeah.
In a movie. He just has that look. Kevin Conway as Curtis LeMay, you mentioned. There's one of my favorite actors in this movie is a guy named Elia Baskin. And he plays the Russian diplomat that Robert Kennedy talks to.
Yep.
Comic fans might recognize him as Mr. Ditkovich from the Spider-Man films. But he is also in one of my favorite 80s films ever, 2010. He is the Russian cosmonaut that befriends John Lithgow and is always getting sayings wrong. Like, he's like, easy as pie, or easy as cake. No, easy as pie. And I just love him in this role because he is he's got the consummate Russian accent, so he's got that kind of nail. But it's just the director surrounded the principals with all of these kind of heavy hitter character actors, so no one is overshadowed or underplayed. It's so amazing to watch.
Yeah, in that list, we have to talk about Michael Fairman, who is an actor that you've all seen in a million things. I couldn't name you. For any of you listening, you've seen this guy.
He is a that guy.
Yeah.
He is a consummate that guy.
He plays Adlai Stevenson, and it is a tremendous performance. Because Adlai Stevenson, for anyone that really is familiar with him as a historical figure, he was the guy that ran against Dwight Eisenhower in 1952 and got crushed. And then he ran again in 1956 and got crushed even worse. And so it's like he's sort of synonymous with the sort of this loser guy. But nevertheless, he ended up becoming the ambassador to the UN under John F. Kennedy. And he has a tremendous scene in this.
Oh, yeah.
Where they confront the Russians in the court of public opinion. And there is a moment where he's talking to his Russian counterpart. And the Russian, of course, they've got the whole thing with the interpreters. Because, you know, Adlai talks and then you hear the interpreter, blah, 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 blah. And then the Russian guy's going, da, da, da. And then the Russian guy answers. And Adlai is trying to corner the Russian guy into admitting, look, you're saying there are no missiles in Cuba. And we have pictures that there are. So what's going on here? And the whole setup of that scene is that Adlai is weak. He's old. He's too ready to appease, and Robert Kennedy wants to get rid of him. He's like, he's just not man enough to do this, to hold his own in the court of public opinion. And at one point, Adlai Stevenson corners the Russian guy, and before the interpreter finishes, he says, don't wait for the translation, answer me now. And that got to this huge round, because you're like, yeah, he's being tough. Now, of course, that line was used in Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, during the scene with Kirk and Christopher Plummer.
Yeah.
And I saw Star Trek VI long before I saw this movie, and so I didn't know that that was from real life, that they took that from real life. And so when I saw this movie, I went, where do I know that line? It's like, oh, it's General Chang said that to Kirk.
Well, because there's the scene earlier in the film where they're all kind of sitting around with Kennedy trying to figure out their different options. And Adlai Stevenson's the one that's like, I'm going to be the coward here. Why don't we do this?
Yeah, why don't we trade our missiles in Turkey?
Yeah.
Which we're not even using. Why don't we trade them? And everyone just dismisses that.
And it's almost like a sports movie where they're trying to take like the pitcher out before, you know, he screws up the game. But he's just like, you know, the Russians kind of, you know, brushing him off, going, you'll get your answer, you'll get your answer. He goes, I'm prepared to wait till hell freezes over. And there's this moment where everybody watching just goes, yeah. And it's one of those great moments. And the great thing is, it's dramatized, but this happened. I mean, this is one of those great things. So it's kind of like in this film, you have this old dog politician who is just about out to pasture, and he gets a little side story where he gets to redeem himself. And it's one of the, like you said, it's one of the best parts of the film. And I think that's what I love about this movie, is that there are like these big, almost, I don't want to call them set pieces, but there's these big confrontation scenes, and that's kind of how I mark time in the film. Okay, we're past this part. Okay, we're past the UN. Okay, now we're past the blockade scene and all that. And one of the more interesting things about this movie is that it actually has a Kennedy in the cast.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Playing the pilot who goes on one of the runs over Cuba. And it's one of the funny things, it's almost comedic, except when one of the pilots actually does get shot down. But Costner has to get on the phone and say, don't get shot down.
That's right.
And they're like, okay, I'll do my best. He goes, no, you don't understand.
Yeah.
You are not to be fired on. And they're like, we can't really control that. He's like, no, really, you're not getting what I'm saying here. And the pilot that Kennedy plays just lies through his teeth. They get back from their run where they were fired upon, and they're like, wow, man, look at these things. It's like sparrows.
Sparrows, yeah.
They're sparrowheads. Is that 30 or 50 caliber sparrows? They're bird strikes, gentlemen, and that's how we're going to play it. And you just realize that in times like this, these people had to go against their chain of command, not their chain of command, but their rules of engagement to keep from plunging the world into nuclear Armageddon. And it just made the film, the death of the pilot that gets shot down has the one moment of the film where I feel is a little over dramatic of Kevin Costner in slow motion running down the hallway.
Yeah.
But it's still that is kind of made up for by the end of the film where Kennedy composes his condolence letter to the pilot's family. And what I love about that is that after everything's done, we haven't forgotten the people that died to get us to this point. And another aspect of this film that I absolutely love is the music. Trevor Jones does the score, and I have this. I listen to it because it's got this kind of dark quality to it, but there's also this kind of heroic quality to the music, especially the ending scene where everyone's congratulating each other. There's this beautiful orchestral moment where it culminates in this. It almost puts the hairs on the back of my neck up. I mean, it's one of the things that it sounds like, though. I'm rambling all over the place. I do apologize. I love this movie that much. If you listen to it, though, it sounds like the opening theme to The West Wing.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I could see that. Those two things have, you know, a lot in common, where it's a sort of like, you know, a positive view of government. You know, it's like, this is when these guys were smart. They had the world's best interest at heart, and they were trying to get things done the right way. And then The West Wing obviously is fiction, and this is real, so-and-so. But yeah, you have that feeling of you're rooting for these guys, even if you were, I think, or someone who was not, you know, a Democrat or thought Kennedy was a good president. You can't help but, you know, want these people to succeed. And there's a great scene, you kind of pivoting off what you're talking about. There's a great scene where they find out that the New York Times has the story, mm-hmm. and they're going to run it. And it's ahead of before Kennedy can go on television to talk about it. And he's like, this is going to ruin all of our diplomatic efforts if the Times run it. And so they call the publisher of the New York Times, a guy named Orville Dreyfus. And he's played by an actor named John Aylward, who's been in a million things. He was on ER. He always plays like a doctor or a lawyer. He's always like a guy in a suit. And they're talking to the guy in his kitchen. And President Kennedy is like, I'm asking you not to run the story. And Dreyfus is like, I can't do that. My guys are going to kill me if I don't run the story. We have it. And Kennedy's basically saying, look, you know, you got to do this for the country. You got to just hold on it for a day. And Dreyfus says, look, what do I tell my guys? And Kennedy says, tell them that they're saving lives, including their own, by not running this. And you actually are rooting for Kennedy to succeed. When I think in real life, like if you'd heard about this today, like, I mean, you know, everyone knows pretty much, anybody who listens to the show knows my politics. I would be uncomfortable if I heard that Obama had leaned on the head of a newspaper not to run a story. That would make me uncomfortable. But yeah, you hear Kennedy, you're like, yeah, do it. You're like, come on, man, play ball.
And the nice thing about that scene is that Dreyfus also goes, you know, we listened to you on the Bay of Pigs and
right,
you know, they took a bath over.
Right, yep.
But I think it goes to the heart of something where it would make me uncomfortable. But I think there are things that we don't need to know about. I honestly believe that. I am for an open government. But if it means if keeping something from me prevents nuclear Armageddon.
Well, right.
Or the ratcheting of a thing. I'm okay with that. And, you know, but you couldn't do that today.
Right.
You know, yeah. if Obama had asked a newspaper publisher or the head of one of the major networks or one of the heads of the major news cable outlets, you know, that would be all over the news.
Yep.
And it would turn into this huge thing. Yeah. Where in the 60s, we were a little more simplistic about these things. We a lot of crap went on behind closed doors that we never knew about, and everyone was just kind of okay with that almost.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, it's like, I agree with Kennedy on that. If it, you know, and I love, it's one of Greenwood's better deliveries of when he says it'll save lives, including their own. It's just like, oh, crap. I mean, I just, there's people I feel bad for in this movie. Pierre Spengler, what is his position? He's their press secretary.
Press secretary, yeah. Who's they completely cut him out of everything.
Yeah, and I feel so bad for him. He's like, what am I going to tell everybody? I'm just trying to do my job here.
Now, Mike, I have to interrupt you because this is very funny to me. You were referring Pierre Salinger. You called him Pierre Spengler because, of course, Pierre Spengler is one of the producers of Superman the movie.
Oh, wow.
So, that is always on your brain, Mike, no matter what happens.
Well,
Superman comes into
Superman.
This.
I mean, Jonathan Kent is Kenny O'Donnell in this film. Actually, a couple of O'Donnell's family is in this. One of his grandchildren plays one of the military guys, and his son, Kevin, is one of the photo interpreters at the beginning of the film. Which is really kind of weird. If you look at the IMDb page, you have Matthew Dunn playing Kevin O'Donnell, and then Kevin O'Donnell playing NPIC photo interpreter. So I like knowing that they're in the background, basically. You know, because the family, O'Donnell's family is important to the film, but they're not pivotal. There's this great scene right before everything really the crap is going to hit the fan, and Costner goes to see his son play football. And this is like a weird thing for everybody. Like his son really doesn't know what to do. And his son's like, you know, all my friends are asking if we're going to be okay. And it's Costner or Kenny O'Donnell maybe seeing his son for the last time. And it's so dramatic. There's one of the best exchanges in the film is O'Donnell asks Robert Kennedy, you know, what's the protocol? Well, you know, if the alarms sound, you know, somebody will go get the families and they'll all be taken here. Of course, that's all for show.
Yeah.
We got 90 minutes. And it's just basically like, no, we're all going to die.
Yeah.
If you're here, you are going to survive and your family is going to die. And it's just, it's heart-wrenching to think of being put in that position. Because you want to survive, but at the same time, do you want to survive at the expense of losing everybody you love? So
yeah.
I think they did a really good job of bringing home, you know, just how scared everybody was. And thankfully, without like constant stock footage of people, you know, like they only have a few shots of empty grocery store shelves.
Right.
And stuff like that. So we don't see like panic in the street. And it is much more historically accurate than X-Men First Class, but you know, you kind of would want to hope so.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and they, including, you're talking about, you know, how scared everyone was, including the Russians. They don't paint the Russians as, oh, these are the bad guys that are doing this thing. It's sort of like this thing has just spiraled out of everybody's control, and at the time, everyone lacked the protocols to deal with it. And that's something that Kennedy and Khrushchev were faced with. Well, it was like no one ever thought they'd be in this position, and they just didn't have the diplomatic tools at hand on how to deal with it. And I thought that was a nice feature that the Russians are, you know, they're a little they're by moving the missiles into Cuba, they're doing something purely aggressive. But it's all gotten out of control. You don't get the sense that anybody is necessarily trying to start anything. It's just. They're just not in control of their sort of faculties, as it were, of how to handle all that.
Well, when O'Donnell goes and Robert Kennedy go to the Russian consulate, the first thing they see is the smokes, the chimney, like smoke is just billowing out of it. It's like they're burning all their papers.
Yeah.
You know, they're preparing. And when Robert Kennedy and his Russian counterpart are having their conversation, you see Costner looking at the secretary, and she's terrified because she's in a foreign country on the verge of war. I mean, she doesn't know if she's going to live or die, and she's like not even in her, you know, on her home soil.
Right.
And there's even some detective work. I love when they're trying to figure out if they can trust the backdoor envoy that they have, and it turns almost into like, you know, like a detective story. It's like, well, we're going to look at all these people, and who does Khrushchev know, and were they ever together? Well, they were friends in school. So it's just like, wow. You know, like today you would just Google that.
Yeah.
But they're going through like these, you know, like all of their intelligence and stuff, and it's just, it makes for a really gripping movie experience. And like you said, there's like three different films in one. But nothing feels out of place. Nothing feels jarring. There's hardly any bad scene transitions or, you know, performances by anybody. So I think that's why, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's a 2.5 hour movie that does not feel like a 2.5 hour movie. It just, the pacing of this thing is just beautiful because it's not too fast. I mean, it's basically Baby Bear. You know, it's not too fast and it's not too slow. So you can really, you know, you watched this with Nixon and the other film you mentioned. I usually like to watch this and then watch JFK, even though, like I said, JFK, beautifully shot film. The director's cut is a thing to behold. The things Oliver Stone does in that film is amazing. Historically, I don't buy almost a single bit of it.
No,
so.
but it is gripping cinema, though. There's no doubt about that.
So, but it's just, you know, it shows that these people were people. You know, these were men, you know, obviously now revered by some people because they were able to go through this, but they were just in this position at this time. This could have been Eisenhower 5 years before, or it could have been Johnson 5 years later.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, we're showing how Kennedy dealt with this. And, you know, there are people that hate Kennedy this day. Just as I'm sure there will be people that hate every single president we have had in modern history till the day they die. But while, you know, it doesn't get into, you know, the more salacious elements of it, you know, his presidency, you know, there's no, like, call for Maryland, Mr. President.
Yeah, you don't see girls running out of this. Although there is a mention, they go through a tunnel at one point.
Yeah.
And there's like, this is where Harding brought in his girls.
Or even, like watching them, like, you know, take the mick out of each other. Like, you know, Kennedy, when they're getting out of that tunnel, you know, Robert Kennedy's like, you try to ride, you know, in the car with this fat ass on you. And McNamara goes, you were excited. I say no more.
That's right. They can have some fun, even in the face of nuclear Armageddon. They could also have a good time, you know? Yeah. Yeah, there are some really good laugh lines, too. I mean, we've been going on and on about how gripping this movie is, but there's some good laughs. I mean, there's some genuine laughs. It all comes out of character. These are all well performed. Like I said, all the performances are tremendous. These are all real guys, and they're all brought to light by these, you know, a real murderer's row of character actors. And with the three leads, you know, those guys are great, but then everyone else supporting them is just tremendous. It's a really fantastic collection of actors put together in a good story and well directed by Roger Donaldson, who is not a particularly distinguished director in terms of his films. He's kind of a generic kind of skill. Sort of a generic set of films. He's done Species, that movie with Natasha Henstridge, and he did like Mr. Baseball, I think, with Tom Selleck. I mean, he's not a particularly, you know, renowned director, but he directs the hell out of this. I mean, he really does a great job with this story.
Yeah, the cinematography is great.
Yeah.
The set design is wonderful. You know, the costuming, it's like where everything comes together in this perfect storm of a film. I would recommend, if it's probably still available through Amazon, pick up the DVD release of this, because this was released in the early 2000s, where DVD was still new technology, and nobody knew how to put together a DVD package. There was no set way of doing it. And they have this thing called Infinifilm, which is something that New Line Cinema kind of had on some of its DVDs, where it's basically a fancy way of saying we have special features.
Yep.
And there's this great, like, almost hour documentary on the Cuban Missile Crisis that goes back to 1948 and really talks about the Cold War and why everything came to a head the way it did and why this was so significant in East-West relations after the Cuban Missile Crisis, because once they realized, holy crap, it's this easy, you know, certain protocols were put into place. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't close calls here and there. And I have known people who worked intelligence in the 60s, and they said it was kind of a scary time all the time.
Mm.
Like, the fact that they went on to lead, quote-unquote, normal lives afterwards and didn't, like, go completely crazy is kind of a testament to the human spirit.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think what this does is it's kind of a snapshot of a crisis of 13 days in October in 1962, where we were on the brink. And every, you know, it could have gone either way. And I mean, there's amusing stories. There's the creators of the Rocky and Bullwinkle show during 1962 had this thing where they were trying to make the country that Boris and Natasha come from be nationally recognized as a real country. So, and they went on this tour of the United States in like this van where they were basically collecting signatures, and they roll up to the White House during the Cuban Missile Crisis and are turned away, and it was kind of like a scary experience.
Wow.
But they didn't know,
right,
because it was
not,
before
right.
It came out. So I've been waiting for years to be able to tell that story, because
wow.
I saw it in a documentary once,
I've
and now
never
I have
heard
a place
that.
To do it.
That's amazing. Jeez. Well, you mentioned earlier in the show about that you talked to your dad. I asked my dad too, because my dad was alive in this time, and I said, "Dude, like, what was it like? Were you?" And he said that we had heard about it, and it was concerning. He said, but by the time that it really sank in to everybody, it was over. That was how he remembered it. That it was – everybody was like, wow, what is going on? It's weird. And then before it really sank in, the crisis had passed. But so I was like, okay. But I was like – I was so fascinated that, you know, geez, Dad, you lived through this. What was that like?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, they don't do a whole lot to show what the man on the street was doing. But the address that they dramatize, you know, you see people watching television and you think, you know, there's probably some people listening to this that can't fathom when there were three channels plus local affiliates. But, you know, everybody watched that speech because
yep.
there was nothing else on television. I mean, it was on the radio, it was on television. I mean, but it's just like one of those things where, you know, there are a few moments in history where, you know, everybody in America has that you can remember where you were when this happened.
Sure,
you know,
yeah.
Kennedy's assassination, the Challenger explosion.
Yep, yep, yep.
You know, 9/11 and all that. And I think this is one of those moments where everybody living at this time will probably remember where they were and what they were doing when they heard this speech. You know, and it's just, you know, they show like the typical stock footage of people watching TVs through, you know, on display in shops on the street, which I never really knew how that worked, because how did the sound come out? it's like the thing Mark Waid makes fun of every once in a while, of people, you know, communicating by the big Trinitron in Times Square. There's no speakers in that thing. How is that happening? So, but that's a funny way of saying, you know, that's the kind of thing I think of when I think of this time period, is people huddled around, you know, like televisions on the street and, you know, like with their families in the living room and all that. And it's just, I just love that this film can put you in that time period so completely that you kind of feel like you're there. You're watching this. It's almost, it's got, as much as it's a drama, it's got almost a documentary feel to it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a terrific movie about a real life event. And I feel like it's, you feel better educated after you've seen it. I mean, it's fictionalized, but I feel like you can reasonably say that you have some knowledge of this very important event by having seen this film. And I think it's unjustly sort of forgotten. And so I would absolutely recommend that anybody interested in American history or just pivotal moments in world history to give this a try. And aside from even wanting to learn about history, it's just a really solid entertainment. It's just a great story, well told.
And I think Rob and I want more people besides ourselves to actually see it.
Yeah, so. That's right. I want to be able to talk to other people about this movie. So Mike and I showing up at that club that we have every week. It's just the two of us sitting there with our real-life Kennedy pins on our lapel. And that's, you know. So, yeah, it's a really great movie. So 13 Days, anybody should check it out. I mean, it's just really, really solid entertainment, and the kind of movie that I don't want to say they don't make anymore because this movie's not that old, but
no.
It's just kind of straightforward drama. I feel like if they tried to make it today, they'd be like, "What's the hook?" Well, the hook is the end of the world. That's the hook, you know. But now we would have to dress it up a lot more and sort of respect it for that. So, it's a really, really solid movie. Is there anything else we want to say about it before we sign off, Mike?
No, I think we talked it up.
I think we did. So thank you so much, Mike, for coming on the show and talking about this. I really appreciate it. This jumped out of me right at the very near the beginning of me starting this podcast. I think I asked you about it, and this was on the list. I was like, we got to get to this. So where can people – oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I just love that I threw you with it. I really do.
I love it when I see things like that. When I see a movie that I thought I was the only person that saw it, I was like, oh, geez, that one, that's great. Other than Batman's Bailey podcast, where it's Batman talking about what you do every day, where can people find you on the internet?
Michael woke up today. He didn't get to eat breakfast, which really upset him. I can't believe that made me laugh so hard, because I just had this thing of Batman sitting in the Batcave with like a really cheap microphone.
Who would not listen to that show? That would be great.
The main place you can find me is Views from the Long Box, which I have managed to take from its very irregular release schedule and managed to like get it out just about every week this year.
Very nice.
And Rob is going to be on in the future of that show as well. You can find that at viewsfromthelongbox.com. I haven't updated The Fortress in a really long time, The Fortress of Baileytude at fortressofbaileytude.com, but it does have a lot of features. I have a really, a pretty thorough section on the death and return of Superman, which apparently some algorithm caught, so I'm quoted on the Amazon page for the Death of Superman graphic novel.
Are you really?
Yeah, it's really weird. But if you're interested in Superman, specifically the post-crisis, that site is also the home of From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, which you can find at fortressofbaileytude.com. Jeffrey Taylor and I are going through the post-crisis adventures of Superman. We're about to get to Shag's favorite story, The Death of Clark Kent. I know he's a big fan of Conduit, so I'm sure he's going to be, you know, tuned into that one. And right now he's hating me because I know how much he hated that story. And every Tuesday night at 10:30 Eastern Standard Time, head on over to the Superman homepage and hear Superman homepage webmaster Steve Eunice and I do a live radio call-in show called Radio KAL Live, where we are finally not having to talk about Batman v Superman.
Isn't that nice?
I am so done talking.
Let the healing begin.
But we've got a lot of stuff to talk about right now with Rebirth and everything, since they're actually paying attention to Superman again. So, but those are the places really that I can be found.
When you think about it, he compared it to Batman v Superman, the Chris Cuban Missile Crisis really wasn't all that difficult to deal with.
Well, I joke that now that it's happened and we're in the midst of it, really Man of Steel was the Korean War Superman fans, and now we are in Vietnam.
Oh, Lord. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's okay. So, I so agree with that. Mike, thank you. thank you for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate it. Anyone who wants to contact our show, of course, you just go to firewaterpodcast.com, use the contact page, or you can send us an email at firewaterpodcast@comcast.net. And you can follow the show on Twitter at Film and Water Pod. So, Mike, again, thank you so much for doing it. I really appreciate it.
It was a really big pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.
I think if you go back over the history of recent weeks and months, you'll find, for example, that on the end of September, I think September 28th, the Secretary of Defense, Mr. McNamara, returned from a trip to Berlin and did something rather unusual. He called an immediate news conference, as you may remember, within a few hours after he returned. And he started talking about our nuclear-armed forces in Germany. Now, this is very unusual. This was quite a striking departure. We've never before made a point of it. And he also said, and you made quite a point of it on one of our shows, that Berlin was the worst crisis since Korea. I think at that time, the administration began to be aware, or at least to conclude, that the Russians now have decided to make a real issue out of Berlin and to move ahead. And then I think you have
George,
to...
George, I...
I got just one other point on this.
George, I regret that we don't have time for even another point.
Go ahead.
It looks as if our report from our correspondent is that there is not a great deal of reason for optimism tonight. That's the report from the CBS News staff. This has been Walter Cronkite from the CBS Newsroom in New York.
This has been a special report from CBS News.